Well, hi folks, welcome back to Naturally Adventurous. This is Ken and Charlie, once again recording from our countries of birth, the United States and the United Kingdom, respectively. I guess we're probably going to do a series of podcasts now where we catch up on all the travels we've done in the earlier part of this year. We were quite busy, and one of the things that kept you busy in earlier 2023 was you spent, what, 3 weeks in South India?
Oh, that was just recently. This was just a few weeks ago.
So that was pretty much your last trip.
Yeah, I went from a period of back-to-back tours, exhausting, like four tours in a row with just a few days off. And I went straight into a pretty hardcore personal trip with my son. So it was kind of a... They say change is as good as a rest, but I was pretty tired. So.
It wasn't much of a change either.
No. Just wasn't getting paid. Yeah.
The first question is, who is easier to guide, your tropical birding clients or your son?
My son. He's got his quirks, but I know where he's coming from. So he was good. He was good. He
handled it well. That's good. Mm. There were no wailing cisticola, wailing Felix incidents.
It's actually easier to wake him up at 5 a.m. to go birding than it is to make him brush his teeth, though. So some things were kind of simple, but other things were not. The birding aspect was quite nice.
I gotcha. Oh, I'm eager to hear about it all. I think being with your son is kind of a fascinating aspect of this. You know, I've never done a birding trip with any of my kids. My son is he's five, so he's. I'm starting to think
he's
about
ready.
It. You know, maybe in a couple. He's ready. Maybe in a couple of years, it'd be quite fun if he takes to birding.
It was eight for Felix. I did birding with him since he was a baby. Actually, since before he was born. Did I ever tell you that?
I don't think so.
So I heard one thing that you could do while you know your wife is pregnant is you could play music or sounds against her tummy. I got a few bird calls. I got my speaker, and I was playing bird calls through her belly to Felix. I was limited to just 10, so I chose very carefully the top 10.
Just 10? What kind of a birder only knows 10 birds? I mean,
well, just not to overwhelm him, you know, when he's still an embryo, you know. Yeah, so we started young, but I'm very happy that he fell into it, and COVID was great for that because we were always out birding together, and he got real serious into it. And then this was our first post COVID trip that we'd done, first like serious birding trip together, just the two of us. So it was overseas. Yeah, so it was great.
So we haven't gotten into Thailand much yet, but we were both in Thailand. And as we referenced last week, we actually crossed paths a couple times in Thailand. And one of the times we crossed paths, we were basically you and I and the folks I was guiding, and then your son and like a friend of his or a kid that you're teaching about birding. We all intersected on top of the Doi Intanon. And it was quite a fun morning. These kids had incredible energy. I mean, they were literally like sprinting up and down this boardwalk, but they weren't just like running around randomly. I mean, they were super focused on the birds. And I guess Felix really wanted to see that rufous-throated partridge. And I was really hoping that like I'd wander off and get it and then he'd miss it and I could grip him off. But in the end, you guys ended up finding it before me and gripping us off. And then we actually went and found it in the same area where you had it. So...
We were all down there together and we heard it calling. We were all kind of huddled around, you know, your two clients and my two kids. And, you know, I'm playing it and it came in fairly close and stopped. And then, you know, and then it started going further away again. So you guys kind of gave up. We kind of went back in and then tried again in the same spot. And the second time it kind of ran straight out. So we thought it gripped you off, but you managed to grip it back.
We actually had an incredible view of it when we came back. We found them in that area, but then I found another couple just under the boardwalk. There was one walking under the boardwalk, and there was one just sitting on a log. It's quite amazing for such a shy bird. Well, let's get into India. So I guess you've never been to South India before. Have you been to Sri Lanka?
I've been to Sri Lanka. I had actually been to South India before. I mean, I've actually spent 6 months in India. Six months of my life in India.
But you weren't birding much during some of those travels.
No. I mean, I had binoculars with me and a bird book, but I was just kind of wandering around aimlessly and, you know, checking off things that I saw. So it was completely unfocused and whatever. So I'd been to several of the... I'd been to some of the tiger reserves, but, you know, there was a lot of new stuff. I didn't get any of the specials. Yeah, we did do Sri Lanka as a family and with another couple of friends.
That's right.
Tarek,
yeah.
Who you know.
Yeah.
That was maybe, might have been 4 years ago, something like that.
Back when you had pneumonia.
Yes, when I had pneumonia and the pregnant lady had to carry my scope. that trip.
Okay, so, but you'd never done focus birding in South India. So India is such a huge, diverse place and they're just, I mean, it's one of these places you have to do like at least 4 kind of 3-week long birding trips to even start
It's kind of 4 points of the compass, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, it's kind of like east, south, northeast, and north central are like the 4 essential India trips. You and I communicated a bit while you were setting this up, and you were initially thinking about just full on backpacking and like trying to get buses around and hitchhiking. And I was pretty strongly recommending like get a vehicle, get a driver.
Yeah.
Did that prove to be good advice or do you wish you'd done it on the cheap Yorkshire style?
I do kind of, but I can kind of imagine how it would have worked out. I would have seen, you know, far fewer birds and it would have been far more grueling and more frustrating. The way it was very nice. You know, we had a very nice driver, a nice car for a very reasonable rate. But sometimes you just want to be a little bit freer, you know? You want to just wander off on your own and see some stuff. But that's one of the things I wanted to discuss a little bit about. You know, when you go to different countries, you have different amounts of birding freedom, you know? If you come to Thailand, you've got a great amount of birding freedom. You can go into parks on your own. You can wander around on your own. You can climb mountains on your own.
That's true.
You know, you can bird all over the place. Yeah. You've got a huge amount of birding freedom. You know, you've got to follow the rules in the parks, but you don't have to be with a guide and you don't, you know, you pretty much get wherever you want to get to. But India is not like that. India, a lot of controls and it can be, for very kind of independent birders like you and me, it can be quite frustrating.
Yeah. What do you think drives that in India? Why is it so different than Thailand? They're kind of in a, you know, in a somewhat similar like GDP bracket, right?
I don't know. It could be British love of bureaucracy that kind of rubbed off on the Indians, or I don't know. But it always comes down to safety. What they say, oh, it's elephants, sir, elephant. And it's like, well, you know, there's elephants in other places too, but it doesn't mean that you've got to have all these controls. So, people often do put it down to safety, that you've got to go with a local, you know. But then you see all the local people walking around on their own, and why do you as a foreigner have to be completely, you know, have a bodyguard like the whole time? It's it's kind of frustrating. I think you just have to go with it. You have to accept you're a foreigner in India. You're expected to have a local guide, to have a driver, and that's just the way it is. You just gotta kind of live with that.
Yep, India is just kind of this package deal, and it's like some parts of it you might love, some parts of it you might hate, but it's just this incredible bundle, this like overwhelming bundle. It's kind of similar to Africa in terms of that, right? Like, other than maybe South Africa and maybe parts of Namibia, in general in Africa, you're very much shepherded around and guided. And I mean, a lot of it has to do with there being a lot of people in rural areas and you're essentially on somebody's land. At least that's what often drives it in Madagascar or Africa, I think. Whereas, you know, Thailand is so much wealthier now and people are so urbanized and the kind of rural hinterlands, nobody's that worried about them, you know. It's just like, do what you want. you're not like walking through somebody's front yard in quite the same way that you are when you're on the way to some marsh in Madagascar.
But I think people want to kind of make some money out of it. You know, you're here. Okay, you know, this is guide. You please go with the guide, or you know, it's I think there's an expectation that you've got to leave something. You've got to pay some people. You know, it's not a rich country. There's a lot of people who could use the money. So yeah, share the happiness.
Yeah, which is understandable and not totally bad. I guess it would be nice if that could happen in like a, how would you say, in a way that didn't detract from your experience. There are places where like you do pay fees and hire guides and it actually enhances the experience. And then there's times when having to do that, jump through those hoops, kind of detracts from the experience.
And sometimes it just kind of holds you back. You know, a lot of the time we kind of, oh no, you can't go here, or you can only go in at this time, or you can only go in this way. And I'm thinking, if I just walked in here and went birding on my own, I would actually see a lot more than following all these rules. So it can be quite frustrating. And on my trip, I actually did follow the rules. I can give an example. I was staying at a lodge, and they said that you can't walk around outside. You know, you've got to go with a local person. And I was like, oh, that's fine. So I said, you know, can we do a bird walk? And they're like, yeah, we'll arrange you a local guide. You go with him. And we went there. And then still there was like a local park ranger who just came up and started giving us hassle. And there's another thing before I go further in this, which is cameras in India. When I did my first day's birding on this trip, there was two Indian guys we were birding with. And one of them was asking the other one, he said, about the place that we were going to go. He said, is there any camera drama? to the other guy, and I was like, camera drama? What's he talking about? Camera drama? But I came to see a lot of camera drama on our trip, and often, so you'll pay to go in a park. You know, I mean, there was one park. I think we paid like just 50 rupees or so. You know, it's like less than a dollar to get in, but then to take a camera in there was like $10. So like 10 times the entrance fee just to take a camera inside. And people seem to think that if you have a camera with a big long lens that you're making $1 million out of it. You know, you're, and again, you need to kind of share this wealth a little bit of all this huge amount of money that you're going to be making for the photos that you're taking. It's just so far removed from reality and so frustrating. And often, you know, it can be a lens over a certain length or under a certain length. So I would go in with my big, and they say, oh, this one. So this is 1,000 rupees to take this one. And I show my son's camera and they go, oh, no, this one, 500 rupees. So it's kind of ridiculous. And you know what, how they say taking pictures in India?
Clicking.
Is it clicking?
Are you clicking?
So you are clicking? You are clicking with this camera? And I was like, yeah, yes, I'm clicking with this camera. I want to tell you about this one time when I went out with a local guide and we started walking, and there was a ranger came by on a bike, and he starts speaking, I think in Tamil, with a local guide. And hey, have you ever seen that? There's like a little cartoon, and it and there's a dog listening to his master, and then you see what the guy is saying.
Yep.
And then you have another speech bubble with what the dog can hear, and it's like Rex, blah 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 blah. Yep. Rex, blah 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 blah. Rex, you know, he could hear his own name, but nothing else. But it was kind of like that. I was listening to this kind of Tamil conversation, and the words that I was picking up were foreigner and clicking. So,
clicking,
so then they would like get foreigner clicking this click, and this ranger he started pointing, because I had my scope there as well. He says, "This, you clicking with this?" And I was like, no, I'm not clicking with this, just the scope. And he says, "How far?" And I'm like, "What? How far? What?" He says, "How far you look with this?" And I'm like, "I don't know, you know, just 100 meters." And he says, "1 kilometer," and you always want to kind of play it down a little bit, because Because you know that the further you can see or the further you can click, it's going to cost you more money and cause more problems. So I'm like, so I was trying to play this down. No. Only 100 meters and no clicking. And this one is pointing at my camera. This one clicking. And but this whole thing of foreigners clicking. You know, Indian would be 50 rupees, but a foreigner would be, 500 rupees, and a Indian clicking is 100 rupees, and a foreigner clicking is like 1,000 rupees. So it's this whole ridiculous camera drama and dual pricing and just nonsense. And you've just got to kind of be patient with it and take a deep breath and just smile and wag your head, which I was trying to get into doing. Of course, in India, you don't nod or shake your head. You wag your head from side to side, from kind of shoulder to shoulder, where to indicate that the positive. So
affirmative was, and cooperative. You're signaling receptivity and kindness and all kinds of things. It's kind of an enigmatic gesture, but mostly positive.
So yeah, it was that side of things was quite interesting.
So, Charlie, we should probably mention at this point, we actually discussed fairly seriously, like, whether or not it was appropriate to imitate the kind of Indian English accent in this episode. And we concluded that we've imitated every other type of accent.
We did
an entire episode about South African
Brits,
accents. Right.
It would only be fair.
It's only fair. And it's a wonderful part of India. It's you know, we're in no way like demeaning anyone. I mean, we poke fun at everybody, including ourselves and our own cultures. Every culture has its quirks. There's this lovely accent in India. And I mean, we have to acknowledge that most of these folks, English isn't their first language. They actually speak English like remarkably well. And you can communicate almost anywhere in India. It's actually quite amazing. But people speak English with this cool, distinctive accent. One of the things I love about Indian English is there's a lot of very, literary and complicated words used. I mean, people are often very well educated. So you get this combination of, words that aren't used, say, in the UK much.
Anymore. Often it's exactly. Quite dated. They're using words from 100 years ago that no one uses anymore, which is fascinating.
Oh, it's just delightful. And so we're gonna do Indian accents from time to time. We really don't mean this in any way to like poke any more fun at Indians than we do anybody else. We hope we don't get canceled because of this. And if you really object to this, please do let us know. We're happy to hear from people, but that's where we stand. All of what you describe in terms of like the rules and the negotiations and the clicking, it's just also familiar to me, having spent a lot of time in India. And as I'm mulling this over, as you're describing all of this, what I realize about India is, well, there are certain places where you have rules and they are just absolutely fanatically adhered to, right? So that's like Australia. It's just like, these are the rules, mate. No deviations.
This is Australia.
This is how we do things here, right? You've got, a lot of Western Europe is that way. Sweden struck me as that way. It's like the rule is the rule. And then you have some countries that are like borderline anarchy or, pretty much do what you want and no one is ever going to challenge you. And then you've got a place like India that is kind of in the middle. Like it's pretty anarchistic in some ways, but at the same time, there are a lot of rules. And so there's basically like this constant negotiation and navigation of these rules where everybody kind of wants to do whatever they want all the time, but there are rules and they can get in some trouble. And so to illustrate this culture, I'll tell you a short story from one time when I was in South India. We were in, I guess, Mudumalai, which I think is a national park in Tamil Nadu. And we're looking for this rare minivet, very scarce, kind of a dry country minivet. And this park is incredibly rule-bound. I mean, everything we tried to do in this park, we were running up against some kind of rule. I mean, I kid you not. There was always an issue. There was always drama. It wasn't, I don't even remember camera drama. It was just endless rule drama. One of the rules is that basically you can't get out of the car. because there's a few tigers, and there's bears, I guess. And I mean, there's some dangerous animals. They're not at very high densities. And it's one of these places where you see local people walking around everywhere, but you know, foreign tourists can't get out of the car. So we're basically trying to look for this little songbird from the vehicle, which is pretty hard. You know, we're driving around, we're scanning for it, we're stopping. It's just not happening. The local guides, they basically know, okay, this bird is going to be in this area, but we can't explore it because we can't get out of the vehicle. However, they're trying to kind of make a plan. And so the local guide and the park ranger with a gun, they're getting out of the car and they're ranging way off into the bush to try to find this bird. And us tourists are like sitting in the vehicle and we're kind of wondering like, like what is going on here? And basically I figured out eventually what's happening is they're scouting for the bird. If they get caught out there, it's much less of a big deal than if a whole group of foreign tourists does. However, if they locate the bird, then they will take us out of the vehicle and escort us over to where the bird is. And we'll try to see it quickly and get back to the car and not get caught. This is the kind of thing you constantly have in India. It's like, we're kind of trying to follow the rules and we might get in a lot of trouble if we get, you know, we break the rules, but there's this flexibility to it.
That definitely rings a bell too. I actually spoke with a guy and I was going to go birding in this one. It was on along a road through a tiger reserve where you're not supposed to get out of the car. And he said, oh, yeah, go up there and you may see this bird and this bird. And I said, what, like, well, I'm not allowed out. And he said, oh, you just kind of get out and don't go too far. And if someone tells you to get back in, just say sorry and then get back in. You know, he said that was the that was the MO.
Yep, that fits right in.
But in general, you know, you walk through. I mentioned this on the podcast I did with the Indian guy, Praveen. When you're going along these roads through the tiger reserves, you see a lot of Indians just getting out and taking selfies. And, you know, in general, Indians, they're not a very obedient nationality.
No.
If something must be done, you've got to tell them in quite a strong way that they mustn't get out or they mustn't do this or they mustn't do this, you know. And then they listen, you know. So they're kind of obedient to a point, but often, you know, they're just kind of doing their own thing and, you know. It's quite interesting, but you see that a little bit when you get Indian tourists coming to foreign countries, you know, where there are very strict rules, and then they're kind of like ignoring them a little bit until you're told quite strongly that you've got to do a certain thing.
Yeah, definitely. So, can you briefly sketch out southern India just in terms of like the wildlife habitats, the biogeography, you know, what's interesting about it to somebody who likes the natural world?
So it's kind of a triangle but with a point facing down. You know, imagine this sort of triangle. And along the sort of left edge, there's this kind of fairly narrow set of mountains that goes all the way along, the Western Ghats. The weather is kind of coming from the southwest, you know, these kind of rain clouds. And a lot of the moisture, it hits these mountains. So along the coast there, it's quite wet. You know, they get quite a bit of rainfall. And then going up the mountains, they get quite a little bit of rainfall. But on the other side, it's quite dry. They have this sort of rain shadow effect. It's not quite as simple as that because there are a few, you know, there's certain gaps and there's other little mountain ranges.
Gap gaps.
But but you get this rain shadow effect where it's kind of wet on one side and dry on the other. And then there's mountains as well. So you've got this kind of montane forest. You've got these different types of habitats sort of going up and down each side. You know, you're getting a montane at the top and then you get like a kind of semi-evergreen. And on the dry side, you're getting even like a thorn scrub, really, really dry habitat, and then dry deciduous and moist deciduous. So yeah, it's all, the topography has a big effect on the habitats on the Indian Peninsula.
Yeah, I think to me the coolest thing in southern India is it's almost like alpine tundra, basically on top of the biggest mountains. It's, you know, it's kind of alpine grassland. It's so cool, you know, and it's so isolated from like the Himalayas. It's like hundreds and hundreds of miles south of the Himalayan range, but it's got these kind of biogeographic links, and there's an endemic goat down there, right? Nilgiri tar,
yeah.
Up in those grasslands, and there's a pipit endemic to that. I really like those kind of extreme, isolated habitats like that.
Yeah, and they get little, you get little patches of this kind of quite stunted forest sometimes. They're called Shola forests, and they call those the Shola grasslands. So it's like a little mosaic of these kind of little stunted montane forests with grasslands. And in those montane forests have a whole bunch of endemic birds to southern India. All these laughing thrushes and different types of flycatchers and stuff like that. There's a couple actually named after the habitat, the Shola. They're called Sholakilis, these little undergrowth flycatchers that are really cool. I think that was certainly one of my favorite habitats to explore, was that were those montane forests up there.
Yeah, I guess there's just a lot of wildlife that in one way or the other is restricted to South Asia, to sort of the Indian Peninsula. And then, that whole larger suite of wildlife is they're all keying into like different subhabitats or ranges of habitats within this incredibly diverse range, which is like rainforest and deciduous forest and dry thorn scrub and alpine tundra. So it's I guess that's an exciting mix. And from the sounds of it, you saw a lot of new birds. You're very well traveled all over the world and in Asia, but you saw a lot of new stuff in South India, right?
Yeah, I gave myself the target of seeing 50 lifers, 50 new birds, and I think I got 52 in the end. And Felix, I had the target for Felix of 100 lifers, because he birded in Sri Lanka as well. So yeah, we got our targets. I think he got exactly 100. He landed on a very special bird, and I got 52 at the end. So yeah, it was mission accomplished for a number of birds. But this was actually planned for April of 2020, but of course, with COVID, that didn't happen. So this has been sort of, and it was shelved after that. But it took 3 years for us to actually push this through and do it. So it was really nice to finally get there and see all these birds that I'd been kind of dreaming of for the last 3 years.
I really like the birds of South India. We're probably going to do a whole nother episode about sort of bird and mammal highlights, but there's just a lot of cool birds down there. And I don't know, a lot of birds that are just really keyed into some kind of fascinating microhabitat. So it's a place I've really enjoyed birding. Sri Lanka is really cool, and Sri Lanka has more mammals, but I think I prefer South India. It's just, and part of what's interesting about South India is that it's more continental. You have way more kind of long distance or medium distance migrants there coming down from the Himalayas or Central Asia. So there's just like, there's higher diversity and there's just more possibility of seeing unexpected things. By the time you get out on Sri Lanka, it's lower diversity. Now you do have a bunch of cool endemics, but it's more of like a known quantity. Like you generally see the same things in the same places.
I think culturally as well, the South is very interesting. I mean, we've done episodes on food before, but South Indian food is just fantastic. They've got some really, really nice dishes. They have these kind of crispy pancake things called dosa, for which you have for breakfast. They kind of roll them up, and or they can serve them in all sorts of different ways. Sometimes they would make like a little cone on your plate, or fold them in a little triangle or whatever. But masala dosa, would have a little bit of potato inside, and then they'd serve it with like two or three little curries or chutneys, which you sort of break bits off and dip them in. You get these little idlis, these little white steamed kind of sour pancakes that you also dip into curry. But it was just fantastic. We just ate like kings every day.
And you didn't struggle to get vegetarian food.
You would probably struggle more to get food with meat in it.
Definitely.
Veg is not, that's normal. Veg is just normal. You say veg, oh yes, of course veg. You get regular restaurants with meat and veg, and then you get a lot of veg restaurants. So, we would just tell the driver, find us a veg restaurant, and he would pull up at some just fantastic local place. He actually took us to one quite fancy restaurant, and we might have paid, $15 for a meal or something for the two of us. And it wasn't that good. It was really, and then he would take us to these other places for, a couple of bucks, and they were just absolutely spectacular and quick. And you'd sit down, you'd have food on your table within, a minute.
Any Delhi belly?
No, not at all. I was there 2.5 weeks. Not a single problem. Not a single problem.
Really?
No, Yeah, we stuck to bottled water. We brushed our teeth with bottled water. We washed your hands. Always in these restaurants as well, there's a place to wash hands before and after because, you know, you're eating with your hands as well. So you've yep. got curry all over them at the end of the meal. So you got to wash before and afterwards. But yeah, absolutely no problem.
So Felix seems a little bit picky with food, which is pretty typical for his age, I think. How did he get on? Was he just loving this food the whole time or did he struggle to find Felix food?
He liked Indian food before he went there. You know, it's one of his favorite types of food. So we cook Indian at home sometimes. We go to Indian restaurants. He loves dal. He loves any kind of flatbread. He loves rice. He can handle a bit of spice. So just any kind of mild curries, he manages no problem. He loves dosa. Absolutely loves it. Loves Oof, dosa. And this was all before he went. So he really landed on his feet. He got there, he just gobbled up the dosa straight away. And he loves eating with his hands. I'm constantly telling him to eat with a knife and fork. And all he wants to do is eat with his hands. So he'd sort of landed in this kind of wonderful...
paradise of hand eating.
Paradise, yeah.
So which do you prefer, North or South Indian?
I think South. I just love dosa. And you could often get the Northern Indian stuff in the South as well.
Yeah,
sometimes.
That's right.
Yeah, there was a dish like, they're still served like paneer and stuff. We're crazy about paneer. My son's favorite dish is paneer butter masala. And he had it once and he just wouldn't shut up about it. He says, can we go somewhere with paneer butter masala? And, you know, and it's not always available. You know, you get dosas and idlis everywhere you go, but not paneer. But he just absolutely loved it.
I think if I was going to have a single Indian meal, it's a very tough choice, but I might go North Indian. But if I had to eat right. one or the other for like a week or more, I'd definitely go South Indian. it's a right. little bit lighter, a little bit... Yeah, I don't know. If North Indian is just like cream and everything and butter and everything, and it's like it's quite dense.
Quite rich, yeah.
More fish in South India as well.
Yeah, especially in Kerala on the coast. Yeah,
Kerala.
A few more. Kerala, I think, has the highest rate of literacy of any state in India. You know, it's a very well educated. I think the population density is lower. It's got quite a chilled vibe, so it's not quite as, you know, intense an experience as, you know, if you get dropped off in the middle of Delhi or something like that. You know, it can be quite relaxing.
You know, I love India, but before I visited Kerala, I really thought of India as a place I would never want to live. But when the first time I went to Kerala, I thought I could easily live in Kerala. Like, this is such a cool place. It's got just a nice mix of like enough development, but lots of forest, low population densities, pretty organized. You know, you have most of the basic services, good shops, good restaurants, airports. Yeah, Kerala is really, really fascinating place. This is one of the things about India. I mean, we obviously speak about it as a whole fairly frequently, but there is so much internal diversity. When it comes even to like the bureaucracy and the political structures of India, the different states have tons of autonomy and they really do run their own show in a lot of ways.
So we were driving from one place to the next, and I wanted to stop for some birding on the way, and we're kind of going through tiger reserves, but just around the checkpost I think you can get out, and there was like a car park there, and I got out and the driver says, no clicking here, this is Tamil Nadu, no clicking. And he says, you go Kerala, clicking, okay. So it was like even something like, you know, taking photographs of birds just by the side of the road is allowed in one place and not in the other. You know, it can be quite different.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on the difference between Kerala and Tamil Nadu. It's so striking. It really is like different countries. Kerala is one of, I think, just in terms of like rankings and stuff, like it's very low on corruption, like, you know, pretty efficient government, good services, you know, even like freedom of speech, and like it's really up there in terms of like human development. And Tamil Nadu is like at the other end of the spectrum for India. It's like low development, high corruption, poor services, a lot of human rights issues. I mean, some of the crazy stories you hear about, like, child brides and you know, various terrible forms of violence in India are in Tamil Nadu. I mean, it's there. And yeah, you drive over that border and it's like you describe. It's like all of a sudden there's a whole different set of rules that apply. It's interesting.
Within Tamil Nadu itself, it's quite a varied place. I found when you're up in the mountains in some of those little hill places, it was still quite nice. It was kind of quaint and nice, cool climate. And, you know, it just seemed to have a little bit more. We really enjoyed ourselves in some of these smaller towns in the hills in Tamil Nadu. And a lot of tea is grown around there. It's very picturesque. And they were kind of touristy, some of the towns. They had lots of nice little shops and restaurants and stuff. So, you know, at night, we stayed in a couple of towns and we just wandered around at night, just kind of stopping in little tea shops and bakeries and, you know, just shopping and stuff. It was really fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's not all bad or anything, Tamil Nadu, but it's just the baseline is quite different there than in Kerala. Yeah,
sure.
One of the things that's fascinating about South India is that is in some ways, that's actually the cultural heart of India. You know, some of the most ancient temples and, you know, some of the most ancient kingdoms were based there. I think people always think of Delhi in the north when they think of India.
I had a Tamil friend and he made a big point of telling me that Tamil was one of the four classic languages in the world. You know, it was maybe like ancient Greek and whatever, but he said Tamil was one of these very ancient classic languages, and they were very proud of their language and their writing system as well.
Now, it's one of these places in the world where you can just walk around a corner and stumble into some, like, 2,000-year-old crumbling, beautiful stone temple, and it's just not even a big deal because there's so many of them. You know, it feels ancient. It's quite special.
We were very lucky in one town that we landed. There was like a festival there. It was going on for a few days, but we kind of were walking around at night, and there was like hundreds of people all banging drums and letting off firecrackers, and they had all these lights, street lights. It was like almost like Christmas lights, but making like Shiva, you know, the god Shiva, and everybody was painting all these little patterns on the ground and dancing and families walking around. It was really fun there.
Oh man, you're making me want to go to India. That's the I think that's the mark of a good podcast, when like one of us really gets the other one want to be where they just were.
Like, yeah,
I want to be in India right now.
It's such a big place, and I really want to explore. I'd love to just go further north and just explore Central India. Definitely want to go out and do Gujarat, and I want to do more in the Himalayas. Yeah, so it's, even though I've spent so much time and traveled quite widely in India, there's still an awful lot to see, and you kind of see it with fresh eyes as well, especially, you know, through habitats, but also, you know, knowing where to find birds and stuff. I'll tell you one of the highlights from this trip for us was some of the people that we met. You know, we had those, what were they? They're like live birding events during COVID.
Yeah, remember that.
There was like a Swarovski thing. I took part in one of those and I was in Chiang Mai. I set up a scope and I was pointing out birds. And there was about five or six other guys around Asia. There was a guy in the Philippines and there was a guy up in the Himalayas in India. And there was another guy, I think, in South India. This guy is Surya. And so I kind of got to know him and we were chatting and he says, "Oh, Charlie, what are you looking at right now?" You know, and we kind of kept in contact a little bit, but he is extremely well connected. And he put me in contact with like all his best friends in South India who were all either working in ecotourism or were guides or were some kind of wildlife experts or really good birders. So I met a whole bunch of these people and it was so cool to meet like young Indian birders and conservationists and just really interesting people. I mean, it was really one of the highlights of our trip.
Yeah. And what was the impression you got out of the folks that you met? Like optimism, cynicism, energy?
You never want to sort of make comments about politics, you know, when you don't really know what people's political views are, like when we're guiding. But they started talking about the prime minister, And I said, "Oh, so do you like him?" And he goes, "Oh, he's an absolute idiot." So they were quite politically outspoken, some of them, but they just had a lot to say on different things about politics and about culture. And it was interesting. I said, I love India. There's so many vegetarian restaurants. And he said, yes. He said, it's terrible. And I was like, what do you mean it's terrible? This is one of the guys. He said, people eat vegetarian food to show their purity. It's like they've got this like sort of superiority complex. That you go to a vegetarian restaurant and it makes you a very sort of pure, special person, you know. And this kind of irritated this guy. But you'd hear all these little opinions and things that you've never heard otherwise. Get people's political views or views on conservation or, you know, how things are, or India's position in the world or what. It's just fascinating to chat with very educated and opinionated Indians.
Yeah, I really enjoy chatting with Indians just in general. I mean, there's 1.3 billion Indians, but you know, I've met a few and I've just met a lot of cool people there. They just always have a very interesting perspective on things, interesting take on things. I think geopolitically, they're at this interesting place in the world where they're, you know, kind of aligned with like the States and the UK and Western Europe, but then kind of sympathetic to Russia. Often fresh takes on things where I just hear a perspective I never heard before expressed by Indians. And, you know, part of what the internal complexity of India is that I might have said this on the podcast before, but it's almost like you have the United States plus another, you know, 800 million people in terms of like income. Like you have some incredibly wealthy people and you have a huge middle class, and then you have like a sort of Western Europe type lower class, and then you have people who are at a lower, you know, income bracket than them. And I think a lot of people just don't get that about India. They just think of like everybody being like low to moderate income. No, that's not the deal. There's just like crazy internal complexity. And there are so many just incredibly well-educated, well-traveled Indians. And, you know, whatever a foreigner might see about India that kind of drives them crazy or that they see as very dysfunctional, like these Indians, they see it too. It's just changing anything in such like a big, complicated country is difficult.
Indians are very confident people as well. I mean, they'll just walk right up to you and just start talking to you. Anybody will, you know. It's they often say the same thing. I mean, it became a bit of a joke with me and Felix, because these people were just, these groups of guys, often they just kind of sidle up and the first thing they'd always say is, "What is your country?" And they'd be saying, "Oh, England or South Africa or whatever we chose to say." And then they said something else afterwards, which was, "What is your good name? What is your good name, sir?" Which is quite funny. But I even got one guy. He said, "What is your country? England." "Oh, what is your beautiful name?" He said.
And what does that mean? Is that like your family name, or?
I don't know. It was just so comical that maybe it's a direct translation from an Indian language where they're very honorific about someone's name or whatever.
But kind of a courtesy, always, you know, honorific, as you name? Say. Yeah. I love that. That's so cool. That's so India. As you say, people are quite confident, and then people speak quite a bit of English. Their English often isn't quite synced up with like modern global English, and you just get these wonderful things that come out. I could probably do a whole episode about like Indian English.
Oh, it's fantastic. Well, Ken, it's been fun to chat about India. It's got me wanting to go back as well. It's a very, you could do a podcast just on India, you know. there's so much to say about the place. It's so fascinating on so many levels. I think we'll do another one with chatting about some of our favorite South Indian birds at a point. But for now, we're going to sign off with possibly one of the most widely heard birds in South India. This was actually a lifer for me on my trip.
Surprising.
The white Yeah, the white-cheeked barbet. You hear absolutely everywhere. And it, from up high in the mountains to sort of down low in the very dry habitats or in the rainforest, it's just absolutely everywhere and just constant all day long. It's, yeah, like a little, like you mentioned before, like a little kind of rollicking call. So, yeah, thanks again for this chat, Ken. It's been fun. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Big thank you to our patrons. If anybody wants to support the podcast, check out patreon.com/ naturally adventurous. And we're going to sign out with the white-cheeked barbet. See you again next time on Naturally Adventurous.